Appreciate all the conversation and dialogue and questions from you as a commission as well. Look forward to working with you on this continued conversation. Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'll go on to the other action item, the elk raffle license. Most of you, I think, are aware of this. For newer commissioners, maybe this will be the first time through this. We do have an administrative rule of the opportunity for an NGO organization that is focused on big game management here in South Dakota, the opportunity to have one of the elk licenses that are technically found within Custer State Park, but it's also available in any unit in the Black Hills where we issue bull tags. The opportunity to raffle off a license on an annual basis, and then those proceeds are used for elk management activities here in South Dakota. Over the history of this, the only organization that has ever put their name in the hat for the opportunity to do this raffle has been the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. And that holds true again this year. We did receive the letter of interest to continue to move forward doing that elk raffle. They are just concluding the current sales, and their drawing will be here over the next couple of weeks for this coming fall. They did send me some quick data that they have in respect to the license sales that they've had so far. And right now, for this year, their net proceeds are going to be right at the tone of about $53,000. And this is continually has gone up the last couple of years that they put more conscious effort in selling those raffle tag tickets. The great thing about this, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation has been a phenomenal partner of our organization and the commission in doing elk management activities in South Dakota. Whether we're talking about radio collaring elk, the elk aerial survey, other research projects, habitat projects, they've been a fantastic partner. And we talk about this opportunity and them raising $50,000 plus for these opportunity to pull off that raffle and pull somebody's name out of the hat to go hunt for that elk. That dollar will probably double or triple the amount that they'll spend in South Dakota for habitat management activities because of other dollars they'll match with it from their other fundraising efforts. So they've been a fantastic partner, and we really appreciate all the efforts they've done in South Dakota. So Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, again, they're the only organization that submitted a letter of interest to this, which we fully anticipated. Knowing their history of the excellent job that they do on it, providing the details, when we have the final report, we'll share that with you. I guess what we would ask for your formal approval of allowing the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation again to do the raffle, which they will pull together and start selling tickets for next year at their first August events, and then throughout the fall and next spring again. And we'll go through the drawing next year again for next fall's hunt. So Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it back to you if you have any other questions, but I would ask that the commission approve the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation again to move forward with raffling an elk license.
Yeah, Sam, do you have any questions? I just didn't ask questions first. You may have any questions. Another question I have is that this doesn't, probably the rarity, you can be a non-resident win this raffle, correct?
In this case, it is still residents only.
Oh, it is. So it's only the local chapters that sell them at their banquet.
It's the local chapters, and they do mailings in South Dakota as well. Yep. So it would be still restricted to a resident to have the opportunity to go do that hunt.
Okay.
The drawings next week.
Yeah, it's coming up. Yes. Yep.
Yeah. There's been a motion to approve by Commissioner B, seconded by Commissioner Bartley. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll notify Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and our continued support. Again, great partner for us in conservation.
Okay, that'll take us to the Nest Predator Bounty Program summary. Jackie, are you doing that for us today?
Yes, I am. Good morning, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, Secretary Roebling. We just finished up here with our 2022 Nest Predator Bounty Program. So we're just still kind of going through some of our numbers here since it just finished on Friday, but I have some preliminary numbers I can share. As a reminder, this was our fourth year that we've had this program. It's a priority of the Second Century Initiative. Again, the eligible species this year was raccoon, striped skunk, badger, red fox, and opossum. And tails, eligible tails were again $10 this year with the maximum payout of $500,000. Something that was new this year, if you remember, just the month of March was open only to resident youth under the age of 18. And then everyone else was able to participate starting on April 1st. So as like I mentioned, July 1st was the last day of the program, and we actually met our maximum on the last day of the program of that 500,000. So just kind of going through numbers, we were just under 55,000 nest predators that were taken this year. So that's up about 2% of what was taken last year. And of those, for the month of March, when the youth only were participating, about 2,100 nest predators were taken by 143 youth during that month. Again, raccoons were continued to be the number one nest predator that were submitted. 73% of the nest predators were raccoons, then followed by striped skunk, 13%, possums, 12%, and badger and red fox made up about 1% of the submissions. This year, it looks like we had about 2,400 individual participants in the program, which is a little less than last year. Of those participants, 32% of them were under the age of 18, which is up from last year. It is a you got to keep in mind, too, that some of the youth, you know, do age out and they fall into the next bracket. And then we're also bringing in some new youth, so those numbers shift a little bit in there, but youth participation continues to be strong, and we continue to partner, you know, with SDSU Extension, with 4-H, and our outdoor campuses. Staff are constantly offering classes on ethical take and fur bears and just trapping 101 type classes. So those continue to happen throughout the year. Let's see, some other numbers. We did hold the weekly giveaway drawing for all youth under age of 18 that participated again this year. So we had, I believe it was 16 winners this year. And those are all on our website if you'd like to see who those winners were for this year. But in general, it went smoothly again this year, I believe. Participation was a little bit down from last year, but it's still holding strong. And I think we had a few more, we had less participants, but the submissions per participant was up a little bit. So with that, I'll take any questions you might have on the Nest Predator Bounty Program.
Thanks, Jake. Do we have any questions for her at this point? Commissioner Whitmer.
Yeah, more of a comment, I guess. Yeah, thank you, Jackie. That's very good. I have to apologize. I wasn't able to take you up on your offer to come and help out with the program. But at any rate, I was happy to hear the strong results. I'm curious on the percentage of raccoons versus skunks. Is that pretty stable over the years, or do you see any particular species becoming more or less of an issue out there for the those nesting birds?
Good question. Through the chair, if I may. Okay. It's looking back since 2019, it sure looks like raccoons have been the species that has been submitted the most over the last 4 years. So that really hasn't changed, and skunks being that second in there. So it's maybe the percentage has slightly changed, but it's been by far raccoons the highest submission.
Any other questions? Thank you, Jackie. Appreciate it. That'll take us on to the next item, which is the river otter season and harvest history I think Alex, you're going to do this one for us, aren't you?
I am. Is everybody able to hear me fine?
Yes.
All right. I'll share my screen here for you guys and give you an update on some River Otter history and such. Thank you again for letting me present. My name is Alex Solm. I'm an upland game biologist with in the Huron office, and I'm going to give you kind of an update on the 2021 hunting and trapping season, as well as just kind of some monitoring processes that we're going through as a department to try to get a good handle on how this critter is actually doing. Advance my slide here. All right. So last year was our second regulated river otter harvest with a harvest limit of 20 otters. Our 20th otter was registered on November 10th, and the season closed on November 11th after the 24-hour trap check grace period occurred. We ended the season with 21 otters, 12 of which were female and 9 of which were male. When an otter was brought into any GFP office to receive their CITES tag, we asked the license holder their target species and their trapper effort, which was calculated by number of traps placed with the intention of actually catching an otter, times the number of days that trap was left out there. All in all, we had 6 non-target catches, and that's pretty much on par with what occurred last year. But compared to last year, our trapper effort actually declined by almost 10 trap nights. So essentially less effort was required by successful trappers. However, when comparing 2021 to 2020, our fall was, you know, pretty relatively mild. We were ice free for most of the fall. And, you know, this allowed folks that were able to trap more efficiently with fewer of these locations actually being covered in ice. You know, it certainly would be nice to get some consistency in our harvest limit, just to kind of get a good trend on trapper effort and engagement with trappers and that sort of stuff. This would also, you know, help explain some of the interannual variation to account for the weather, just so we can, you know, see this on a year-to-year basis. As you can see by this map, majority of our otters were harvested in Moody County and subsequently the Big Sioux watershed. Really isn't that surprising, since Moody County is the source of their reintroduction. We kind of assume that their density is the highest there and kind of a source of their expansion. But you can see we did have some caught up in northeast South Dakota and some of the, you know, the Whetstone River, Red River, that sort of stuff. Now I'll get into some of our monitoring efforts we've incorporated as a department. One thing I will say is we have been told by numerous fur bearer biologists from surrounding states is that otters are extremely difficult to monitor due to their secretive nature and the fact that they live in hard to reach places. I probably sound like a broken record because every time I, you know, give a presentation on otters, I try to reiterate that fact. They're simply not as easy to count as deer or pheasants. In order to properly manage the species, we must develop and utilize multiple methods to monitor their population. So we try to have a lot of tools in our toolbox. At GFP, we're generally using 3 main methods. First method is using information collected by these successful trappers, as I kind of described earlier in the presentation. We can develop a catch per unit effort index, which can be used as an index to abundance in lightly trapped populations, such as our otters. By doing this, we can track this over time, and it gives us a good idea of how much effort it actually takes to trap otters. The second entails a little bit more effort. This is relatively new to our department and something that we developed last year. We developed a stream survey within the Big Sioux River to utilize non-invasive genetic sampling to hopefully identify the number of individual otters using certain sections of the stream by locating their latrines and then subsequently taking a genetic sample from the scat or anal jelly that's located at these latrines. I'll go into a little bit more detail in the next couple slides about this method. And then the third method we're utilizing is opportunistic reports of signs, sightings, and incidental harvest. We can use this number of these observations compared to other years and hopefully see trends in population status or population trajectory. With these, we also complete necropsies on all incidentally harvested otters and subsequent roadkill, as well as our harvested otters during the season. We can gain demographic information such as sex and reproductive status, as well as age, that can give us a good idea of how the population is doing as well. So getting a little bit more into the stream survey, this is kind of the nuts and bolts of things. And our main source of monitoring that we're attempting to do. So we developed a survey to monitor these populations within the Big Sioux River. The survey period runs from about mid-September to mid-October. We selected 23 transects that ranged in length from about a mile and a half to 3 miles and utilized bridges as our start and end points. We did attempt to keep the end points of one and the start point of another at least 7.5 miles apart from one another, just because we didn't want to resample otters or double sample otters. We kind of wanted to make every transect independent of one another. Last year, our focus was really just to determine the feasibility of utilizing this type of survey, proofing our methods, and, you know, making sure what was best for sample collection. All in all, it went really well. It was a really kind of awesome survey to do. And we were able to survey all 23 sections in about a 3-week time frame. In order to complete this survey, we utilized kayaks and searched within the Big Sioux's banks for signs of otter and their subsequent latrines. For those who aren't familiar with what a latrine is, it's actually a communal spot that otters use for depositing their scat and anal jellies. With a little bit of learning and advice from a few folks that are a little bit more familiar with otters, such as other fur bear biologists in surrounding states, we quickly learned what to look for these to locate these latrines. And generally, they were found on the fairly close to the water's edge and on some sort of sandy or rocky embankment. When we ended up locating a latrine, and you can see a latrine there is kind of on the upper left-hand corner, and you can see the tracks associated with it, you know, that was just downstream of that latrine. So those were, two indicators that we're looking for while we were searching the sides of the river. So when we ended up actually locating the latrine, we were confident that was otter. We took samples of each piece of scat or anal jelly present. From there, we hope to get a conservative count of otters that gathered at the latrine with the genetic information from their scat. Using this count, within our defined sampling unit or those stream sections, it can provide us with an index of abundance, such as otters per kilometer of stream. This index will help us establish baseline distribution of otters within our monitoring area and provide us inferences to traditional abundance estimates. At the very least, the survey allows us to track distribution and give us an idea of naive occupancy or where or where not we actually have these critters. Unfortunately, one of the downfalls of this survey is we can't use the amount of scat that's located on each latrine as a good indicator as abundance, because it doesn't really correlate with the number of otters using that actual latrine. One of the main questions, like I kind of said earlier in the slide, is we wanted to see how effectively we could get DNA from these samples. Otters live in environments that really make it hard for their scat to retain viable DNA. They're exposed to UV light for extended periods of time, and they remain wet, which often can affect the DNA quality that you're taking off your samples. So we wanted to test between a traditional collection method where we actually take a piece of the scat and collect it, and wanted to compare it to a newer method where we swab the outside of it, which was just created a few years ago. With some preliminary analyses from the first few transects that we did, we were able to determine that the newer swabbing method was way more reliable at actually amplifying the DNA and kind of getting to the results that we were hoping to get. So with our first successful, quote-unquote pilot season complete, we were able to send samples to the University of Idaho to genetically identify these individuals. Fortunately, we're still waiting on some of the final results to come back. They kind of had a backlog with some other samples that they had to get out earlier this spring. But I am happy to report that I've been in communication with them, and they're really close to getting the results back to me. And all in all, they had about a 51% amplification success rate, which is really, really high for otters. We're hoping to kind of fine tune a few more of our collection methods to kind of improve this number. Some of our preliminary results from the first field season are shown in this table. We were able to collect locate at least one otter latrine on 23 of our stream sections, which is pretty cool, for a total of 36 latrines that we found. We collected, and then on top of that, we collected 101 samples from scattering anal jelly from those located latrines. We plan on continuing the survey through 2025 to see what kind of data we get. If all goes well, there is the potential to expand this methodology into other river systems, such as the Vermilion, James, and some of the ones located up in the northeast South Dakota, within the management zone. And all in all, kind of create a more robust analysis. The more data we can get, the more things we can do with data analysis and abundance estimates and such. Moving on to our opportunistic reports. Again, these are, we can kind of use this as a gauge for population abundance. As I mentioned earlier, these reports are of signs, sightings, and trapping events reported by GFP staff and the general public. These reports are categorized by their validity. So a lot of these ones we actually go in and investigate and make sure that, you know, the person actually saw an otter. It was a realistic report. As you can see here, we've seen a pretty steady incline in the total number of reports over the last few years, which is, you know, very good for the river otter population. I will say, though, 2021 is kind of sort of an outlier. We actually had the Argus leader tag along with us during our stream survey. And because of that, we had staff that were contacted by folks that you know, wanted to give reports of river otters that they seen and that sort of thing, and didn't really know we wanted to collect that information at that point. So we did see a little spike, and that was probably because of that. So these are our incidental reports. So here's just a graph of our incidental catches and other carcasses that were collected, whether it be roadkill or, you know, some unique situation. Again, you can see a steady increase in the number of these catches through time, which can also give us insight into how the population's doing. Generally, most of our incidental catches occur when trappers are targeting beaver. So these, again, you know, 2021 was a pretty mild fall and a pretty nice spring. So I think the increased opportunity from, you know, ice-free conditions caused the number to be a little bit higher than previous years. And kind of added to our overall, you know, non-harvest numbers. One of our last tools in our toolbox utilizes information from these incidental catches and road kills. Like I mentioned earlier, we try to get some demographic information on these otters. This includes age, which is found using the cementum annuli in their lower canines. This can be kind of deemed as age at harvest, or, you know, essentially when the individual died. This information is useful because it allows us to calculate a minimum number of individuals back to their projected birth year. For example, an otter estimated at 5 years of age at their death would be a member of the population for the previous 5 years. This analysis helps us produce historical trends in abundance, and we're able to see kind of a population trajectory to a certain point in time. Because each necropsied otter contributes to a cumulative number of known otters for several previous years, there is a lag in the cumulative total through time. This figure doesn't include the last probably 5 or 6 years of data, just because that data hasn't been collected yet. And essentially those numbers will contribute to the historical numbers. So really what by saying that is any otter alive today isn't contributing to this data set. They just haven't been sampled yet, or haven't had the opportunity to be sampled yet, or for us to actually get the age from them. So we are continuing to collect data as we go. We just have to, you know, kind of look back at a snapshot back in time. Kind of one of the last couple slides I got for me, we had a unique opportunity with our department to provide some insight on otters by doing a cooperative research project with SCSU. This project is looking at the impacts of land use and management practices on otter distribution, habitat use, and projected recovery using not only our existing GFP data, but also additional camera trap data that the student Jessica is actually collecting as we speak. Jess is hoping to model river otter distribution, habitat use, and then come up with something to predict landscape suitability for otters with this master's project. She started field work this past spring, has been really busy placing cameras. She hopes to deploy about 150 of them this year, about 50 at a time, and then she leaves them out for about a month's worth of time. I was able to tag along with her last week sometime to kind of see how see how everything went, and she was super excited about the project, and everything. Everything was going well for her at that point, but cameras were capturing an image a minute. So she has a lot of data analysis ahead of her, and she's kind of figuring out a few ways to analyze the pictures a little bit more efficiently for time's sake. She's actually been successful on a couple of occasions, which is really cool to see. You know, like I sound like a broken record. Otters are pretty dang hard to catch on camera if you don't know where they're, or, you know, that they're there. As you can see in the upper left-hand corner of the picture, she had an otter swim by one of her camera traps. Her data collection is going to continue to occur for the next couple of years, and we're excited to see the results that she brings to the table and how we can apply that to, you know, future management of river otters. We are hoping a little bit down the road that once she collects more data, either Jess or Dr. Cheeseman, who's the principal investigator, will be able to give you guys kind of a more thorough update on the project and actually have some data to present. So with that, I can certainly take any questions.
Thanks, Alex. Does anybody have any questions for Alex on the river otter report? See any? I had one question, Alex, and I think that Secretary Roebling and I talked about this too. When we did the user surveys for all of the licensed trappers, the one suspiciously and, in my opinion, absent target species from trapping in South Dakota was the river otter. Wasn't part of that survey. Can you address that for me as to why the otters weren't part of that survey?
Yeah, we were. Or through the chair. We have addressed that recently. We're coming up with an idea of questions that we can ask and things like that. That we're kind of brainstorming at the moment some of the questions, you know, whether or not the trapper actually targeted otters and in which county they targeted at, to get some kind of idea of how many users are actually going out there and trying to get a river otter. Just wasn't ready to go at that point. We do ask folks that are successful in trapping an otter a few of those questions that we can get at to answer some of the questions that we're trying to answer when they come in and receive it. But like you said, it is a downfall where we don't get to survey those the trappers that are unsuccessful in doing it. But we are in talks of trying to get something added to next year's fur bear harvest question. One of the limitations of it is there probably isn't a ton of people that are out there, and with the low response rate from some of our previous fur bear questions or surveys, we're just a little nervous on how accurate we could think those values are. So we're trying to figure out a few ways to address that and provide the best answers that we possibly can.
Yeah, I'm just curious for my own edification, because I think that a part of our 3 R's, the reactivation part, I've talked to several different trappers that the only reason they got back into it is because they never had the opportunity. So it'd be interesting to see when you get that figured out how we can take a look at that deal as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very well. Thanks for your part. Appreciate it.
Thank you.